On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Hockenberry, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Imagine it's wartime. You are captured by the enemy. You are a prisoner of war. Any war. You choose. Marcel Beauvert, how long were you a prisoner of war?
I was prisoner of war for about 75 days.
Cosmo Fabrizio, how long were you a prisoner of war?
6 months.
And Frank Molinari, how long were you a prisoner of war?
4.5 months.
Do you remember the dates you were?
Yeah, I was captured on December 21st and liberated on either the 28th or 29th of April, I'm not sure.
1945. Well, Marcel Beauvert, Cosmo Fabrizio, and Frank Molinari, along with hundreds of thousands of U.S. officers and soldiers, were captured and held as prisoners of war during World War II. A current exhibit at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Massachusetts, the brainchild of photographer Jörg Meyer and writer Hal LaCroix, documents the stories of 19 prisoners of war. Today we'll talk to three of those men. This hour On Point, the hardships, the heroism, and the lessons learned as a World War II POW. And joining me in the studio are three former POWs. They are all in their 80s, and they were all captured during World War II, the latter part of the war, really, and kept by the Germans in camps throughout Europe. Cosmo Fabrizio was a mortar man during the war, sergeant, correct? Mm-hmm. Marcel Beauvert was a tail gunner on a B-17, also a sergeant. And Frank Molinari was a corporal in the military, but I want you to know that chain of command doesn't... In the infantry, right?
You're in the infantry, right. Rifle.
There's no chain of command here. You know, I'm a civilian, but we're all the same rank.
Right.
Marcel, let me begin with you. What was it like to bail out of a B-17, having just been involved in a bombing mission, and then land among the people that were looking up at your plane with great fear?
Well, I was in the tail, and I was called out of the tail to help the buddies that were in the waist, which was the ball turret gunner, the waist gunner,
right,
and the radio man. And we were throwing things out of the plane to try and we were very busy to try to lighten the weight. We had three engines out. The other one was on fire, and we were going down. We had been in the air since early the morning.
And you landed in enemy territory.
Right.
And the Germans got you immediately.
We were coming back from dropping our bombs, and we lost the formation. So we were lone flyers at that time. And we were very busy. I never even thought of, well, you're going to bail out. That wasn't even part of my thinking at that time. We got hit. And the plane went up in the air as though you were throwing a ball up in the air. When they gained control of the plane, the pilot triggered the bailout signal. And I was not on oxygen at that time or on the intercom. And so I didn't know what was really going on. And so I said to the radio operator who was next to me, I says, what did he say? What did Andy say? And he says, bail out. And so he tried to get the waist door open. He couldn't get it open. So he told me, I can't get the waist door open. And I says, let me see. And so I pulled. What he did was forget to pull the emergency cord. So I went over, grabbed the ribs, swung my feet against the door after I had pulled the red cord, and the door went flying out. And after that, I just rolled out. There weren't any questions in my mind about bailing out. Hmm. When I get out, and I'd pulled the ripcord, I looked up, and I saw the big canopy over my head, and I says, Marcel, you got yourself into this? No, what are you going to get yourself out of it?
Do you remember the face of the German who took you into custody?
No, I don't really remember them at this point.
What was it like to be surrounded by the uniforms of the enemy all of a sudden after
being
in the
plane? Well, that's shock. That's a shock. You have a different flag, and I landed directly next to a AK-AK 88's battery, and they were waiting for me when I got down.
Hmm.
Civilians were there. I had boots tied to the straps, parachute straps, and they took my parachute, they took my boots, and I was there alone. And the first thing I heard was, "Pistola, pistola, halt." You learn around about 50 feet away from you is a rifle pointing at you.
And then a saga began. Right. Let me turn to Cosmo Fabrizio. Do you remember the circumstances of coming into custody and the faces of the people who took you?
Yes, I do.
What were they?
Well, I was captured on September 26th of 44 in Alsace-Lorraine. I was with the 3rd Army, which was Patton's, and it was in the 35th Division, the 134th Infantry, Company A.
And Patton was running you pretty hard.
He was fast. Well, one day we walked 65 miles because he had no gas for the trucks. And we got there, we were pooped. But he was fast. He didn't believe in taking it easy. The minute that we were up, we were moving. And you move until he said stop. And at that particular time, where it's now Alsace-Lorraine, the Germans were on a counteroffensive. And my squad was more or less surrounded, or not surrounded, but in a V form, and we had the mortars going as fast as we can, you know, shoot them. Till we ran out of mortars, then all we had was our rifles. When all our ammo was gone, there was nothing to do but hands up.
How did that feel?
Well, they said, "Hands ho." That's the German for hands up. Terrible. But it was either that or get killed.
Right.
In other words, you commit suicide. There's nothing else we could do with the rifles except try to bang them over the head. But before you did that, you got with a Schmeisser, you're down. Hmm.
So suddenly you're in the custody of the people you've just been shooting at. Again, you can't feel terribly good about your prospects at that point.
No. Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
And all you kept thinking of is, we can try and keep alive. Hmm. That's the only thing.
Frank Molinari, do you remember the moment you were suddenly in German hands?
Oh, yes. I remember very distinctly. As a matter of fact, I was with the 106th Infantry. We were as green apples. And we went up to the front lines on the 12th. A group of us from my unit, battalion went up on the 12th of December, and we relieved the 2nd Division. And not knowing all the details, I'm only a corporal. Like, they don't tell corporals what's going on.
But what was going on at that time was the Battle of the Bulge, right?
That was the beginning of what was going to be the Battle of the Bulge. When I got up there, one of the fellows from the 2nd Division, I saw the patch, and a buddy of mine was in. I asked him if he knew him. He said, "No, I don't." He said, "You got nothing to worry about, kid." He says, "This is a piece of cake." He says, "We even got bunks underground here." He says, "We're going to stick around with you for a couple of days and take you out and on patrol, et cetera, et cetera." And I said, "That's fine."
Didn't turn out that way, did it?
Well, on the 16th of December, such a military force, the Germans had probably taken 3 months to build up, hit 2 regiments from my division and devoured us.
Wow.
They surrounded us. They had us. There was shell firing in the forest. No matter, you had no place to go and run. You couldn't fight a tank with a rifle. We had no ammunition. Our trucks haven't reached us yet with all the supplies. We had nothing but what we carried on that day. And we fought till the end. And on the 19th, there was a ceasefire. And my lieutenant, who was a West Point graduate, who went through West Point in 2 years and 4 months because they wanted to get the officers in the military, they needed them for the war, he was younger than I was. And he says, we have orders to surrender. And I'm not going to tell any of you that you have to. If you think you can get out and you want to go, go. And I said to myself, if I surrender, thinking this, this is the enemy. I mean, what I just saw, I mean, they weren't going to pat me on the shoulder and say, good boy. I thought they were going to kill me.
But and you surrender, right?
I know I didn't.
You didn't.
I took off. Me and two other fellas took off.
I mean, you were told by your West Point commander.
He was my lieutenant.
Right. To surrender. That the orders were to surrender, but you had your own option. If you wanted to take your chances in the woods by yourself, you could do it, and that's what you chose to do. Was that the bravest decision you ever made?
No. It was a stupid decision. I should have listened to him and gone down the hill with the rest of them. Maybe I wouldn't have been treated the way I was when I did get captured.
How were you treated?
I was beaten because I didn't surrender. On the 19th, they felt, well, maybe I had no ammunition, and neither did the other two fellows have any ammunition, because we encountered one group, we shot off the few rounds we had, and then we were running for our lives. The next thing we know, we got into a gully, and we were surrounded for 2 days and nights. We didn't sleep. We just kept running and running. And when we got captured, the frontline soldier, the man that captured me, he just put the bayonet right up to my neck, and I don't even know if he had a bullet in that rifle or not. I don't know. And I thought I was going to die right then and there. And he frisked me. And I had some cigarettes on me. And he asked me. I didn't realize he was asking. He asked me for a cigarette. And I said to him in English, you got the rifle, pal. You can have anything you want. And he took one cigarette and put the rest of them back in my pocket.
That amazed you?
That amazed me.
Yeah.
And I said, this guy's going to treat me pretty good. I mean, this guy isn't going to beat me up or anything of that nature. No way. So they took us, and they marched us down the road for a while and turned us over to another group. This group, there was an officer and four other men. And they got captured. They decided to take off. What I thought was, you know, and they told us that we had to fill in the ruts in the road. And this is when I says, all that noise I was hearing when I was on guard duty at night were tanks being slid off of sleds that they were bringing up with mules and horses.
Well, you got captured and found yourself suddenly with a kind of a random work detail of just some rogue soldiers off behind the front lines.
Behind the front lines.
Let me ask Marcel, and I want to continue that story in a moment. Let me ask Marcel and Cosmo. You were in a prison camp, at least for a while, and you also were shuttled around a lot. You know, in the war movies, we get this sense of what these prison camps were like, the Great Escape. You know, you kind of tunnel out, you act like a smartass like Steve McQueen, and, you know, nobody slaps you down too much. Everybody looks like a movie star. I gather it's a lot different in your memory, Marcel.
That's right. We were captured, and they marched us up to the gate. And an officer turned around, and he says, don't be foolish. He says, like this fellow was. And he pointed to a coffin that was near the gate. He never opened the coffin, but you got the word.
Yeah, I wouldn't have needed to see inside the coffin.
No.
No.
And they marched us down the street and met the other three men that were with me. Now, we stayed that night in either a church or a school. looked more like a school than a church, in one room that was had hay on the floor, no food. The other three men were with me. Another group came in later on that were flyers, and they were in another room. In the morning, they turned around and gave us two guards, and they marched us off again and put us on a railroad track at a railroad station, and we got into a regular passenger car. And they took our shoes, and I'm sitting in the chair, in the seat, and this a German soldier, big guy, because I'm a little guy, and this big guy picked me up by my chest, threw me on the floor, and took my seat, and he's there yelling. So the guy just turned around and says, "Go sit over there." And so that was, you know, as far as that was fine. That, you know, I didn't think that they would do that, but they did it.
Hmm.
What I was told was that he was yelling and everything because I was a prisoner, I was the enemy, and he was fighting for the Germans.
Well, certainly stories of vulnerability, and boy, yeah. when you're among the enemy, anything can happen. Cosmo, what was your treatment like?
Well, with the exception of transportation and food, I wasn't beat up or nothing. But that was the main, the main harassment that we got.
Was the transportation, the conditions of food
right.
and water?
Well, after I was captured in Alsace-Lorraine, it was taken to Wahlberg. We were there two nights. And then from there, we went to Stalag 12A, which is in Limburg, 75 miles. We went by troop train. Well, a freight car. 5 days for 75 miles. 1 day's rations. We got into 12A, and it was more or less a congregating camp where privates, PFCs, corporals, sergeants, and officers were all taken there. Then they were separated and going to different, you know, camps. Privates in one camp, PFCs in another camp, corporals and sergeants in another camp, and officers in a different camp. And from there, I was there 2 weeks, and all you got was grass soup.
Grass soup?
Grass soup. I mean, you go out and cut the grass, throw it in a pot, and boil it, and that's it. No seasoning, no nothing. And rotten potatoes.
Now, did you have any sense that you were protected by the Geneva Convention or the Red Cross
yes,
or anything like that?
Yes, but we never saw it. Not in the beginning. From there, they sent us to Stalag 3C, which was Kustrin, K-U-S-T-R-I-N. And that's a different name today. They changed it. And that is 175 miles. And it's 50 miles east of Berlin. It took us 23 days in freight cars.
Packed in a freight car.
100 of us standing up on one side and two guards on the other side.
Standing up for 23 days?
Well, 100 of us. Those freight cars were not like ours, you know, huge. They were, compared to the big freight cars that we have, they're about like by half the size. You're standing up. 23 days. 5 days rations.
Wow. Some people must not have made it.
They didn't. Is the first 6 days, the first one, you just left standing up until finally we got him out to the front.
Dead so, and standing up.
Dead and standing up. Well, we still standing up. We were so packed. So finally at the first stop that we could get him out so we can relieve ourselves and everything. Called the Kraut, we got a dead one here. And we put him, you know, past the wire fence, the poor thing dropped. What are you going to do? He couldn't stand up by himself. And I figured in the course of traveling those 23 days, there's five of us died.
Wow. Wow. So you were, compared to these gentlemen, Frank, more or less kidnapped by some pretty brutal soldiers.
Well,
what happened when you started your work detail, as it was called?
Well, we were six we'll say, non-coms, as I could see, you know, and one officer. And this officer, he had an officer's coat on, you know, that's, and I took him to be an officer. And they said to me, our job was to take the shovels and try to hit the hard ground and fill in these ruts because they wanted the road so the more troops, if it, or equipment, if it was coming up that road, to get in there. Well, it was. This was known to be the coldest winter in history in Europe. We were cold. We were freezing. We hadn't had no food for a few days. We had rations ran out before the 19th for us. I mean, we had some D-bars, the chocolate bars. They were gone. We had nothing to eat. But the thing was, after a while, you know, I'm bitching. I'm a kid that was bought and brought up in East Cambridge, and I swore a lot. And I started swearing and saying, you know, this S and no good.
Yeah, I've been to East Cambridge.
It ain't right. I mean, get me warm. I'll, you know.
Yeah.
Don't leave me. So the officer says, well, I'm going to find, there was a shack there, he says, and there were three officers in there. He says, I'm going in there and find out what the hell's going on. And with this, he opened his collar, and I see a cross, a chaplain's cross.
It's the German officer? Yeah.
Yeah. No, not a German officer, no, an American
officer.
Well, a couple of minutes later, two German guards took five of the guys and told them, I said, move, you know, let's go. And I started going with him. It's 9. You stay. I says, I ain't staying here alone. And then I turned around and said, wait a minute, to myself. Maybe I can get the hell out of here. They opened the door and they called me in.
This shack.
This shack had a little 24 by 24 stove that they had lit. And it was warm. I was thankful for that. And there was a piece of black bread on the table, and they offered me the piece of black bread, and I took it. I was starving. And I looked around, and I'm saying, where the hell did the chaplain go? There was no chaplain. The uniform was on the floor. He was a German officer.
Wow, so he was impersonating.
He was impersonating. Why? I don't know. I mean, we had no idea who the hell was coming or how much strength we had in the line or anything, and unless these other guys knew. And I don't even know now if the other guys, I knew one guy, he was with me in my outfit, but the other four, that when we got to the group, I don't know if they were Germans or they weren't, but this guy spoke perfect English. And now, here I am swearing, you know, not knowing he's a chaplain to start off with, but I'm swearing out there.
You're in a pretty vulnerable position.
I said, I'm in trouble here. What's going on? Well, the next thing I know is they're unbuckling their belts. These guys, well, they wanted me to perform oral sex on them.
So you were sexually abused in this shack?
Sexually abused. And they started beating the hell out of me because I was fighting them. I mean, I was fighting for my life now because I knew if I did anything they wanted, they were going to kill me anyway.
Wow.
I ended up strapped to the table with a beer bottle. I was sodomized by them. And then they pushed a beer bottle up my rectum.
And threw you out
and
after they were done
out,
with you in a
threw
pile
me
of
out
dead bodies?
On a snowbank just to die.
Hmm. Well, the story of how you didn't die is an extraordinary one. We'll get to it before the end of the hour. But certainly sexual abuse in your case, overcrowding and starvation in your case, severe deprivation and not knowing what's going to happen in your case, Marcel. We're talking with three World War II POWs, Cosmo Fabrizio, Marcel Boisvert, and Frank Molinari. Let's take a call. Linda from Barrington, Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Well, actually, That's my wife.
Ah.
And she called for me, and I'm a POW. And
well, what's your name, sir, and welcome to the program.
My name is Merton Gold, G-O-L-D.
Well, you're among friends here.
Okay, thank you. Where do you want me to start?
So you were a POW in Germany for how long?
16 months.
Wow. Well, what would you like to share that reminds you of the stories that Frank, Fabrizio, and Cosmo have been...
Well, my experience was a little bit different because I was an officer and I was a flyer. And most of the time I was in a POW camp. I was guarded either by the Luftwaffe or by the Volkssturm. I was never guarded or in the hands of frontline infantry troops. So my treatment is not typical of their stories. It's different, and, you know, and...
And it sounds like it's hard for you to talk about.
It was not a piece of cake in it, by any sense. I'm Jewish, and it was very difficult for Jews in POW camps, as you may know. Our bad treatment was mostly psychological rather than physical. In other words, after the bulge, they announced to the Jewish prisoners that they were to be moved. And that was the only thing they told us in advance. And what the Germans did was they moved us to a separate ghetto barracks in the middle of the camp. And the Jews were in this special barracks, and the only other people in the barracks with us were a few of the Black Eagle Squadron pilots who had been captured.
Wow, well, it's certainly an amazing scene that you paint for us there. And I should tell you all listening out there, our caller from Barrington, Rhode Island, was originally his wife. And she was on the phone. Her name was Linda, and he's telling the story of being 13 months in captivity. And so we were surprised when he got on the air. Clearly, Linda encouraged him to come out with a story that was very, very difficult for him to talk about. And Frank Molinari, you've just told an extraordinary story of brutality. How long did it take to get to the point where you could share something like that, even with your family?
I started seeing a psychiatrist at the VA in 1975, Dr. Monnelly, and I never told anyone that part of my life until maybe 1986 or 87.
Wow. You know, the government had a reaction to your disclosing at least the beatings while you were in custody. What was that, and how frustrating was
that? Very frustrating, because I was sent home on a hospital ship. They were going to fly me home, but when I got beat up and I was thrown out in the snowbank, a fellow that saw my patch was the same outfit I was in. I don't know, he probably took off like I did, and he got captured. And there was a group of prisoners of war that were being marched by me, and he saw the patch, and he picked me up.
Kept you alive.
And he said to the guys, he's still breathing. I was all bloodied from just the beating. And I didn't realize what was happening. He picked me up and he asked the guys to help. And when I came to, believe me when I tell you, I don't remember marching or anything. When I came to, I was in a boxcar, which Cosmo described to you, which they called a 40 and 8, 40 men and 8 horses. We had to be 75, 80 people, every one of us standing. You had no room. There was a bucket that they put on these trains, if anybody had to go. Everybody had dysentery by this time. I didn't know what was going on, and Louis Nigro, God have mercy in his soul, he saved my life.
He's no longer with us.
He's no longer with us. I wish he was, and he'd be here today.
Well, God bless me. He certainly did keep you alive. But what is so curious to me in your story is when you told the U.S. government that you'd been beaten and that you had brutal treatment, they told you to keep your mouth shut.
I could not tell the story. I could not tell the press. I could not, because I was very bitter. When I was on the hospital ship, before I got off the ship, we were at Newport News, Virginia. And this civilian came, and he was asking various patients on the ship.
And he was the one who said, you're not allowed to talk about this?
He let me sign an affidavit that I would not speak to the press or tell my story.
Were they worried about bad PR for the Nazis or something?
They were worried because they were worried that if I told the press and they made a story out of it, and maybe some of the people in this country would retaliate against the German prisoners that were being taken care of with three meals a day, movies, their own cooks to cook their food, slept in a bunk every night in a warm bed. And he told me.
For whatever reason, being told that, I imagine, did not contribute to your psychological rehabilitation. That's for sure. Let's take another caller here from Iowa City, Iowa. John, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Can you hear me?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say that I'm very proud of these gentlemen, and I grew up with a neighbor that was taken prisoner. His name was George Niederheiser. And what he taught me still follows me in my life to this day, and all I can say is if these gentlemen open up to people like my neighbor opened up to me, it really shapes other people's lives, and I appreciated what he did for my country, and I appreciate what these guys did, and I was able to be a pallbearer for him in his funeral, and it was probably one of the proudest days of my life. So,
well, John,
that's all I wanted to say.
That's great. Thanks for calling. Marcel, do you feel like you have something to teach because of your experience?
Something to
teach.
Teach?
As our caller was suggesting, that your story is really important for other people to hear. Or is it more a private matter?
It's more of a private matter, really. Hmm.
So you're a little skeptical of this whole greatest generation idea that the World War II generation have some mystical wisdom because of their experiences compared to other generations?
No, I don't really feel that way. I was a very fun kid when I was growing up. The war started, and I knew very little about it, especially in 1939 when I was 14 years old, like a typical 14-year-old. I was in the Sea Scouts when I was growing up, and I was on my way back home on that Sunday that Pearl Harbor was bombed on December 7th. And when we heard it on the radio, we were very quiet. Now, I didn't go into service till after I was just turned 18, and I volunteered the draft, and I went into the Air Force. Everybody was going into the service at that time. There was a tremendous patriotism that was going on. And I just felt that I had to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. What did you think, Cosmo, about the stories that came out a few years back of the prisoner abuse in Iraq and all the discussion of torture and conditions for prisoners and the use of the Geneva Conventions? Did it relate to your experience at all? Did it remind you of anything?
Well, it all depends if it was proven. To me, Gitmo. I have to see the facts before I believe that they were treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
They might have been, and they might have not. So to me, it's a social thing.
What about Abu Ghraib? There's pictures there.
Well, pictures don't lie. And looking at that, I'm looking back during our time as a POW. We had no pictures. All we had was what our own time with.
You had your memories.
That's right.
If people had cameras where you were, there would have been some pretty grim pictures there.
That's right. The only thing we did have that was good was one fella in the barrack in the Stalag 3C was a radio operator, and with a razor blade, a needle, and wire to electric, we had BBC reports.
He made a radio out of what?
Out of a razor blade, a double-edged razor blade.
Yep.
A needle.
Right.
With wire attached to it, you know.
Yep.
And hitting the electric wire up above us.
Well, it's clear we don't need all this equipment in the studio, guys, if you can make a radio out of those things.
That's right.
We can certainly sell off all this junk that we're sitting among. Frank, when you heard the Abu Ghraib story, how did it make you feel?
I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all because it opened Pandora's box for me. But, you know, there's the good and the bad in all of us. I know, the way I was treated, I didn't like it. I still don't like it. I mean, I wish I could have opened up a long time ago because I would have felt a lot better. I would have slept a lot easier. But it took a great doctor, Dr. Kudaraskis, to finally get me to write. I didn't say it. I wrote it.
Hmm.
It took me almost 11 months to write just that part of the history of the time I was a prisoner of war because I didn't want to say it.
Well, your personal therapy and rehabilitation has certainly become part of an extraordinary exhibit. I'd like to bring in another voice to our conversation. Hal LaCroix joins us. He's writer and brainchild, along with York Meyer, the photographer, of the documentary exhibit of 19 POWs at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington. The exhibit is Journey Out of Darkness, American Heroes in Hitler's POW Camps. Hal, thanks for joining us. I want to get to calls, so quickly, what is the value of this entire exhibit? And it is filled with stories like we are hearing.
Well, I would say that it's important that when we're sending men off to war, that we see them as individuals. And the idea of the exhibit is that people will go to the museum, they will look at the photographs of the men as they are now, as old men, 60 years after their experience. They'll look at their service photos, and we also hung on the wall short stories I wrote about particularly gripping incidents from their captivity.
So you got before pictures and after pictures.
After pictures and
one little question. Guys, did you all fit in your uniform 60 years later?
Cosmo did.
Cosmo was the only one.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
And, you know, people are in the exhibit. They're looking at the photos. They're reading the stories. And I think it's, really allows them to have an emotional encounter with the man as much as possible. And you can see, I think, in this way, the real toll of war, that it lasts for decades afterwards.
On some level, prisoners are prisoners. From Watertown, Mass., Michael is calling. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes. The lesson my father brought back from his 3 years of captivity, first with the Italians and then the Germans, was a loathing for mistreatment of people. There were certain types of people he didn't like, but then he would say that, you know, no one should let them starve. He was held outside of Leipzig toward the end, and he was part of a work party that was sent in to clean up after the firebombing. And even though later in life he knew that the firebombing was probably something we didn't have to do, at the time they came in and there was iron burning, and they were so happy to see it.
That was Kurt Vonnegut's story, being in...
Well, yeah, he was in Dresden.
In Dresden, right. That's Leipzig, yeah, close by.
And there was no... At least he never spoke of any of the gross mistreatment, and I'd like to thank you gentlemen for bearing the unbearable, you know, which is more important than heroism, really. But he went from, I think, around 180 to 90 pounds
That's a familiar detail to all of you in here, right?
Right.
He lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, so yeah. He spent the rest of his life trying not to be able to fit into his old uniform and trying to see that no one else would be able to either.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you very much for calling, Michael. You know, I want to remind you, you can go to our website. We talked about pictures of these great men here. You can see a photo gallery of Frank Molinari, Cosmo Fabrizio, and Marcel Beauvert, and the 16 other POWs featured in the exhibit that Hal was talking about at the National Heritage Museum in Lexington, Mass. www.onpointradio.org, and at our website, you can also read the stories. Let's take another call from Newton, Mass. Vince is calling.
Hi, I'm on a train. I might lose signal in a second, so I'll be quick. First of all, I want to thank you guys and the previous caller's comment about burying the unbearable. I don't even know how to put into words how I feel about what you said happened to you. Connecting it to today, I mean, I wonder, you know, when Americans were worried that if word got out that Germans had mistreated them, that they were worried about our people mistreating Germans in retaliation. What does that say about how we put our soldiers at risk if we do the things that have been alleged in Abu Ghraib, et cetera? And I really think that's it just concerns me about how we put our own people at risk by that kind of behavior. I was actually wanting to ask you guys a question. My uncle was a nose gunner in a B-17 in Europe, and he said towards the end of the war, their instructions changed, and they were warned that if they were captured by civilians, they were at much greater risk than if they were captured by armed forces, because there were...
Let's take an answer, because we're running out of time, Vince. That's a great question. Frank, you're nodding your head?
I know a fact. See, there were two types of camps. The Air Force was put in Luft camps. The ground forces were put in Stalags. There was a difference. And I was marching after when we got the 4B and we got in indoctrinated as prisoners of war and given a dog tag. From there, Louis Nigro said to me, "Mo, you've got to rip the goddamn stripes off. They won't let you out of here to go to work." And I did. I ripped the stripes off, and we went out on the work detail, and we kept on marching. And we went through a town with a pretty good-sized town. I don't know what the name of the town.
Right.
But I saw airmen who had to bail out of their planes hanging from the light poles.
Killed by civilians. Right.
If you got captured by civilians...
It was over.
It was over for you. You would pray, if you knew, to be captured by the military.
Marcel, does that jive with what you were told?
That's true. Yes. We were the Fliegers, I guess that's what you'd call them. Mm-hmm. And I can remember one time where the group of us were outside of a railroad station, and civilians started coming after us. Mm. And luckily the guard is the one that really told us, "You don't say anything, you keep quiet, we take care of this."
Well, Cosmo, you're not keeping your mouth shut anymore, right?
No.
No. The story's out.
Story's out.
And I want to...
Finally was released from our word, I might as well say.
Right.
And...
Well, thank you so much for being here. I mean, we could go on for another hour. And thank you, Hal.
It's a pleasure.
Really appreciate you coming in and everything. Quickly.
John.
Yep.
Can I say, please...
Got to be really quick.
If there's any POW out there who hasn't been into the VA system... Please, come in.
All right, go see the VA. Right. Thanks to Frank Molinari, Cosmo Fabrizio, and Marcel Beauvert. All were held as POWs during World War II. Also thanks to Hal LaCroix, writer and inspiration behind the exhibit in Lexington, Mass. More information at onpointradio.org. I'm John Hockenberry, in for Tom Ashbrook. Thank you, everyone. This is On Point.